All right, tonight I want to pick up where we left off in 2 Samuel chapter 16. It's where we left off. And if you remember from last week, we were going through chapter 15. I mean, Absalom is now in revolt against his father David. And it's a fulfillment of the prophecies that Nathan had prophesied against David because of his sin with the Bathsheba and how God said that the sword would not depart from his house. And so now his son Absalom is leading a complete rebellion against his father's kingdom. And David, when he got wind of Absalom's rebellion, David got together all of his faithful servants and a number of other people in his household and the people that were loyal to him, and now he's on the run. But, you know, when we were going through some of the people that were following him or that were, committed to David when he was on this run, I didn't have very much time last week to elaborate on some of these people that were following David. But I think it was kind of interesting because we read in chapter 15 that when David is now fleeing for his life, he has these Chariathites and also the Peliathites that are in alignment with him, and they throw in their lot with him. And from what I understand, these were foreign soldiers, and from all the studying that I could do about these people, apparently they were Philistines that threw their lot in with David, and they became one of his closest bodyguards. And I think that's kind of significant because that chapter 15, it deals with these people who were really faithful and loyal to David, who were once God's enemies, God's sworn enemies. And I think that that says a lot because David, you know, I've mentioned over and over and over again, in so many ways prefigured Jesus Christ. And even though he's being punished for sins, nevertheless, even this episode in his life where he's trying to escape from his son Absalom's rebellion and the things that God is putting him through, I think you can see, in a sense, a parallel. I don't want to make too much of a mental stretch here, but you can see a parallel because right now, Jesus Christ, he's not ruling and reigning on this earth, obviously, at this particular time. He's in heaven, obviously, but he will return and he will, you know, establish his kingdom and his throne. But at this particular time, you can almost make a parallel that Jesus Christ has been ostracized from his kingdom, so to speak, on earth. And, you know, this world is just filled with God-haters. And I've said so many times before, the people leading this charge, like the ACLU or the people in academia or the people in our entertainment industry. And it's getting to the point now, people are becoming more and more hostile towards Christians. I mean, you can see the handwriting's all over the wall. And Jesus himself said that there's coming a time in the last days, he says that because wickedness would abound, the love of many would grow cold. And, you know, I'm seeing it all over the place. And this is a situation where you see people who either are going to throw their lot in with David or they're going to be staunchly opposed to David. And I feel like that's what we see now. But what's really going to have its climax, it's going to have its climax during the tribulation period. During that 7-year tribulation period when the Antichrist will be ruling and reigning this world, towards the end, there's going to be absolutely no fence sitters. People are either going to be totally sold out to Christ or they're going to be in total hatred and opposition towards him. But I thought it was kind of interesting. You look at the different people that were faithful and loyal to David during this particular time. I mean, it says a lot in regards to being instructive to us as far as, okay, David's on the run. Seems like he's about to lose his kingdom. From all, I guess, outward appearances, it looks like David is finished and through. And in many respects, you could apply that to Christianity today. And now when things are really getting difficult when it comes to living for Christ, I think people's true colors are beginning to come out, whether we're going to remain faithful to him in the midst of this perverse and wicked, evil generation, or if we're going to just throw our lot in with the world and the flesh and the devil. I mean, that's the choices that we have today. Anyway, I wanted to pick up where we had left off in chapter 16. And it says here in the beginning of verse 1, it says, "Now when David had passed a little beyond the summit, behold, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of saddled donkeys, and on them were 200 loaves of bread, and 100 clusters of raisins, and 100 summer fruit, and a jug of wine. And the king said to Ziba, Why do you have these? And Ziba said, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride, and the bread and the summer fruit are for the young man to eat, and the wine for whoever is faint in the wilderness to drink. Then the king said, and where is your master's son? And Ziba said to the king, behold, he is staying in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. So the king said to Ziba, behold, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours. And Ziba said, I prostrate myself. Let me find favor in your sight, O my lord the king. Now, before we go any further, now David's on the run here, and this particular guy, this individual Ziba, if you remember what happened when David was trying to find any surviving member of Jonathan's household, he discovered that Mephibosheth was Jonathan's son, and that he had been lame from the time when his nurse had dropped him. And long story short, David ended up having him, Mephibosheth, eat at his table, and he honored Mephibosheth for Jonathan's sake. But when you read this incident, a couple of things I think are noteworthy. First of all, this guy Ziba, he seems to be a very loyal individual when it came to throwing his lot in with David, and he brings all of these provisions for David, because remember, when David got word of this revolt that was going to take place, David knew immediately he had to flee, and there wasn't a lot of time for him to get together a lot of provisions. I mean, him and his servants and his household and everybody just basically took off running, because they knew that time was of the essence, so they didn't have any provisions at all. And so here, some of these people who are loyal to David meet him, and you know, I don't want to make a big issue of this, but it records everything that this Ziba had brought. In other words, you know, it says here in that verse 2 that he had brought bread, he brought summer's fruit, he brought wine, he brought these different things. And it doesn't just simply say that he brought provisions for David's men. It lists what he brought. And I think that that's kind of instructive or kind of significant, because I don't think God overlooks anything. Everything that we do for his name's sake, I think, it's written down, it's recorded. Jesus himself said that, if you do so much to give a cold glass of water in my name, you know, to the least of my brethren, it will not lose its reward. And you see this Ziba is an individual who throws his lot in with David. But now something, I think, arises where there's going to be a question mark in everybody's mind about what he accuses Saul's son of doing. Because if you look at this verse 3, David asked, where's Mephibosheth? He asks, where's Jonathan's son? And in that verse 3, it says, and the king said, and where is your master's son? And Ziba said to the king, behold, he is standing in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. Now, I don't know if that's just a flat-out lie, or if there's something, some truth to that. Because when this story develops a little bit further, we will find that Mephibosheth has a different side of the story. And you almost don't know who to believe, and David, in a sense, is not sure who to believe either. And I'll comment on that more when we come across this encounter, when David meets face-to-face with Mephibosheth. But I think it's kind of significant here, what's said there. There might be some truth to it, because this Mephibosheth, he would be in line for the throne if, let's just say, Absalom died and David died, then maybe he could have thought to himself, well, maybe the throne will be reverted back to me because I'm the only surviving member of the household of Saul. So that might have crossed his mind, but I don't know if Ziba is telling the whole truth there. But anyway, I'm going to comment on that more when we do come across this. But I think what's instructive here is that the people who were committed to David, they made every sacrifice and every effort to throw their lot behind him and throw their weight behind him and their resources behind him. And I think that that's what people need to do today for Christ, even though we're becoming more and more of a minority. In the end, we're going to find out that history was on the side of the people who threw their lot in with Christ and not those of his enemies. Anyway, beginning at verse 5, it says, and when King David came to Baruim, behold, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. And he came out cursing continually as he came. And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David and all the peoples and at all the mighty men were at his right hand and at his left. And thus Shimei said when he cursed, get out of here, you man of bloodshed and worthless fellow. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned, and the Lord has given the kingdom into the hands of your son Absalom, and behold, you are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed. And Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head. But the king said, what have I to do with you, the sons of Zeruiah? If he curses, and if the Lord has told him, curse David, then who shall say, why have you done so? Then David said to Abishai and to all of his servants, behold, my son who came out from me seeks my life. How much more now this Benjaminite? Let him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him. Perhaps the Lord will look upon my affliction and return good to me instead of his cursing this day. Now, this Shimei, he was loyal to the household of Saul, and he's accusing David of a lot of things that David was not guilty of. But you can see there's a great deal of animosity and resentment and bitterness, people who were loyal to the household of Saul or related to the household of Saul, towards David. And I think a lot of, I don't know, just the contempt that was built up there, there's a malice that they had for David. A lot of it was unfounded. You can see it with this Shimei. He's accusing David of being a man of bloodshed, of killing people in Saul's household, which we know is not the truth. But here's the thing. This Shimei, if you go back to Exodus, when we went to Exodus chapter 22, I think it's verse 28, I mean, God specifically says, you shall not curse God, nor curse a ruler of your people. And this guy's just coming out and just cursing David up and down, left and right. He's throwing dust in his hair and throwing the rocks and I guess everything else at David as he's fleeing. This man is just absolutely full of contempt for David. There's no question about it. And like I said, you can see a lot of people today who are just absolutely filled with hatred and malice and animosity towards Christ, towards his followers, towards Christians, towards Christianity, towards the Bible. This guy really epitomizes a lot of the people you see today. At least he had the courage to go out there and make himself known. A lot of people are just, I think, had that same kind of feeling that Shimei did, but they didn't dare go out there to make this kind of spectacle of himself. But we're going to deal with this guy later on, too, because he's going to come face to face with David, and then you're going to see a complete turnaround. But you can see that in his complete turnaround, the guy is really not, David doesn't trust him, because you can see the absolute contempt that he has for David and for his men. But interesting, too, this verse 9, it says, then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, you know, I failed to mention this a couple times when we were talking about the sons of Zeruiah. That's really David's sister. Apparently, David had two sisters. We know that Jesse, David's father, had eight sons, including David, but there's hardly ever mentions of his sisters. But he has two sisters, Zeruiah, and also Abigail is one of David's sisters. So this Abishai is basically David's, his cousin, or his nephew, rather. And you see a situation here where, as this develops, that some of David's even closest family, they're either with him or against him. And I think that that says a lot, too. But anyway, we'll get to that when we come to it. What it says here in that verse 12, when David said, perhaps the Lord will look upon my affliction and return good to me instead of his cursing this day. And in other words, David left this entire situation in God's hands. I think this is exactly what you see in Jesus Christ. He had the power, he had the authority inside himself to call legions of angels down to deliver him from his would-be executioners, but he just left everything in his father's hands. And so in verse 13 it says, so David and his men went on the way, and Shimei went along on the hillside parallel with him, and as he went, he cursed and cast stones and threw dust at him. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary, and he refreshed himself there. And Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, entered Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. Now it came about when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, and Hushai said to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. And Absalom said to Hushai, is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend? And Hushai said to Absalom, no, for whom the Lord, this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his I will be, and with him I will remain. And besides, whom should I serve? Should I not serve in the presence of a son, as I have served in their father's presence, so I will be in your presence? Before we go any further, remember when we were reading in chapter 15, we read about this Hushai. He threw in his lot with David, and he was following David, and David said, hey, listen, go back and pretend to be loyal to my son Absalom so that you can thwart Ahithophel's advice, because Ahithophel was one of the counselors of David for many years, and everything that came out of Ahithophel's mouth, it says that it was like the wisdom of God. This guy was real, you know, he had such insight, such wisdom, such discernment, such understanding, and such knowledge that people always would turn to him for counsel and for advice. And when David found out that Ahithophel had turned up on him, he needed somebody back there to counteract his advice. So he sends this Hushai. An interesting thing is about this Hushai. We read here at least three different times, and of course we read it in chapter 15 too, that he's referred to as David's friend. And I may have mentioned this last week when I think it was kind of interesting with Jesus when he talked about friends. In John chapter 15, he had said, greater love has no man than this, than the one lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you slaves, for the slave does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard from my Father I have made known to you. Anyway, this is the type of person that I think that Christ wants, looks for today. I mean, people who are sold out to him, people who are obedient to him, people that he can trust, people that he can rely upon, people that are not going to turn on him. And what's also interesting, and I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent here, you look at this guy, Ahithophel, and you wonder, what happened to this guy? He was serving David for years and years and years. He was a trusted counselor, a trusted advisor. And why did this guy turn on David? Why did he throw in his lot with Absalom? Quite frankly, this is totally speculative on my part, but I think what's really kind of interesting is that we read in 2 Samuel 23:34. When we get to that, I'll point this out again, but it's interesting when there's a list there of David's mighty men and the various people in his government and his court. It says something that gives me kind of an indication of what may have happened to this Ahithophel, because in 2 Samuel chapter 23, verse 34, it says, Eliphet, the son of Abishai, the son of the Maacathite, and Elam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gileadite. Now, he was just listed in there in a name of who's who's, but what we read about in Samuel 11, when we already went through Samuel 11, is that when we talked about David and Bathsheba, it says this, so David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And over here, like I said, in 2 Samuel 23:34, it talks about Eliam being the son of Ahithophel. Now, if this is lining up the way I think it is, you know what this is saying? Is that Ahithophel was actually Bathsheba's grandfather. So I get this impression that Ahithophel was kind of been holding a grudge against David for many years because of what happened to his son-in-law. And I think that that's why he's thrown his lot in with Absalom. Now, that's totally speculative on my part, but I think that you got to ask yourself, why would this guy with all of his wisdom, insight, and understanding throw in his lot with Absalom? And I think that that has something to do with it. But nevertheless, I think his treachery is going to come back on his head a hundredfold. And anyway, okay, and at verse 20, it says, then Absalom said to Ahithophel, give your advice, what shall we do? And Ahithophel said to Absalom, go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house. Then all of Israel will hear that you have made yourself odious to your father. The hands of all who are with you will also be strengthened. So he pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof. And Absalom went into his father's concubine in the sight of all of Israel. And the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one inquired of the word of God. So was all the advice of Ahithophel regarded by both David and Absalom. Now, look at the advice that Ahithophel gives him. And I think it's really, really significant. Because remember, when Nathan, you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 9 to 12, Nathan, the prophet, when he was basically telling David that he was going to be cursed for what he did in regards to Uriah the Hittite and having him murdered and taking his wife, this was a fulfillment of this prophecy that Nathan made when he said in 2 Samuel chapter 11, he says, why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing his evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will rise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives from before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight. Now, wasn't that a tremendous fulfillment, right down to the minute detail of what happened here? It says here that he will give them to your companion. It didn't say to one of your sons, but in the fulfillment of this, a companion meant somebody who's very close to you. And here he is, Absalom follows the advice of Ahithophel. Now look at the advice that he gives him. And before we look at his advice, look at that verse 23. And the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave to those in those days, was as if one inquired the word of God. So was all the advice of Ahithophel. In other words, when this guy gave advice, it was such sound, such wise, discerning advice that it seemed like it was from God himself. Well, Ahithophel obviously didn't know that he was being used of God, but this advice that he gave to Absalom was basically a fulfillment of what God had predicted was going to happen. It was almost, you could see God speaking through him. But it says here that they pitched a tent. They pitched tents for the concubines that David were left behind to watch the palace. And then he pitched them out there on top of the roof of the palace for all of Israel to see. And Absalom went into each tent and, I guess, had relations with his father's concubines. It was like, having intercourse with your father's wife. That's exactly what it was. Because now it was going to tell everybody in Israel, there's absolutely no chance of reconciliation between Absalom and David because he's done this thing now. There'll never be a reconciliation between the two. And what it does, it gets everybody off the fence. It gets all the opportunities to just want to sit by and see who's going to win this battle and then decide to join in later with the victors. It gets rid of all those people because they feel like, hey man, now we got to choose. Now we got to decide. We're either going to be 100% for David, or we're going to be 100% for Absalom. And I really see this coming in the future. I see it more and more. Like right now, we're looking around us and we're seeing the way the world is getting. And it's getting to a point where once the tribulation starts, people are either going to act more and more wickedly, or they're going to begin to act more and more righteously. In other words, by the time the seven-year tribulation is over and Christ is returning, there's going to be nobody sitting on the fence. There's going to be no apathetic, lukewarm, indifferent people. There are going to be people who are just totally sold out to the Antichrist or totally sold out to Christ. They're going to be sold out to righteousness or totally sold out to evil. And there's going to be no in-between. And, this advice that Ahithophel gives Absalom, I think, draws that line in the sand where you can't just simply hopscotch back and forth. You've got to get on one side or the other. And that's what he was doing here. And people knew now that, hey, man, if Absalom had a change of heart, all of his followers might be put in jeopardy. So now he was just showing everybody, I'm in this to the end. So that people felt like, hey, well, we can get behind him now. Anybody have anyone to add or share to that chapter 16? Anyway, this same theme he just picks up in this chapter 17, where it says, Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, please let me choose 12,000 men that I may arise and pursue David tonight. And I will come upon him while he is weary and exhausted. I will terrify him so that all the people who are with him will flee. Then I will strike down the king alone, and I will bring back all the people to you. And the return of everyone depends upon the man you seek. Then all the people shall be at peace. So the plan, please Absalom and all the elders of Israel. Then Absalom said, Now call Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear what he has to say. And when Hushai came to Absalom, and Absalom said to him, Ahithophel has spoken thus, shall we carry out his plan? If not, you speak. So Hushai said to Absalom, This time the advice of Ahithophel has given is not good. Moreover, Hushai said, You know your father and his men, that they are mighty men, and they are fierce, like a bear robbed of her cubs in a field. And your father is an expert in warfare, and will not spend a night with the people. Behold, he has now hidden himself in one of the caves, or in another place, and it will be when he falls on them at the first attack that whoever hears of it will say, There has been a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom, and even the one who is his valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will completely lose heart, for all of Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant men. But I counsel that all Israel be surely gathered to you from Dan to, even to Beersheba, as the sand that is by the sea in abundance, and that you personally go into battle. So we shall come to him in one of the places where he can be found, and we will fall upon him as the dew falls on the ground. And of him and all the people who are with him, not even one will be left. And if he withdraws into a city, then all of Israel shall bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the valley until not even one stone is found there. Then Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel, for the Lord had ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel in order that the Lord might bring calamity upon Absalom. Then Hushai said to Zadok and to Abiathar the priest, this is what Ahithophel counseled Absalom and the elders of Israel, and this is what I have counseled. Okay, this is pretty self-explanatory what's happening here, but keep something in mind. Ahithophel was really giving the good advice. He's giving the sound advice. He's giving the right advice, because basically what he's saying to Absalom is, he's saying this, hey man, David is on the run. He hadn't had a chance to get provisions or get organized or to to regroup in any way. He's on the run. What you need to do is give me 12,000 men and we'll go after him right now while he's on the run. He's weary, he's disorganized, he's disoriented, and we'll just fall upon him now, because you need to hit him and hit him hard now before he has time to regroup and set up his forces and whatnot. And that was really the best advice. It was the advice that would have won the day. But look at what it says here. It says Hushai is brought in, and he gives advice. And Hushai is David's friend. And Hushai could see that Ahithophel's advice, he knew that was the right advice. But he thwarts his counsel by giving a different counsel, a different advice. And his advice really does seem sound. It seems solid. It seems like it's the better plan. But it really wasn't. What he was really doing is he figured, hey, David needs time. He needs time to regroup. He needs time to organize. He needs time to rest. He needs time to plan. He needs time to marshal his forces to prepare for this attack. And so that's what Hushai is really doing. He's buying him time. So he really appeals to Absalom's vanity. He figures, okay, Absalom, why don't you go out and lead all of Israel against your father? You be the one. You lead them. And when you get everybody from Israel behind you, you know, you get thousands and thousands of forces with you, man, you'll just cover them like the dew, and, that'll be the end of it. Well, you can see what's happening here is that God's working this through this thing, and it's Hushai is really giving him the bad advice. But it's really the advice that's going to be saved David, and Hushai knows it, and so does Ahithophel, because it says this, back up there, verse 14. Then Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel, for the Lord had ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel in order that the Lord might bring calamity upon Absalom. I mean, Absalom, this guy, like I said, he was physically, he was a very, very handsome, tall, appealing individual. That by all outward appearances, this was the person that the people wanted as king. But this guy had absolutely no character. This guy had a real flaw as far as his spirituality was concerned, because this guy had absolutely no conscience. Like I said, he killed his brother Amnon. He turns around and, you know, leads his revolt against his father. He wants to kill his father. He sleeps with 10 of his father's wives. I mean, this guy, you know, is just a wretch. But that's why the Lord's planning to put him to death. And then in verse 15, it said, then Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar, the priest, this is what Ahithophel counseled and Absalom and the elders of Israel, and this is what I have counseled. Now, remember, Zadok and Abiathar, they were the priests who were going along with David when he was fleeing. But David said, go back, bring the ark back, and what you could do is act as my eyes and my ears, and be spies, inform me what's going on. So these are priests who pretend to be loyal to Absalom, but they're really sold out to David. And that kind of says something too. You know, even in this world, in this day and age, when Jesus Christ is basically in his rejection, Jesus himself said that, we're to be wise as serpents, but innocent as doves. And I think at times in this conflict, the spiritual conflict, I mean, we really do need to confront these forces of evil in ways that I think show a great deal of wisdom and a great deal of insight, a great deal of understanding. And sometimes we just have to be as wise as serpents. And Jesus himself said, don't give what is holy to the dogs. Don't throw your pearls to swine. They're going to turn on you, going to trample on your feet. So sometimes in dealing with certain groups of people, you really got to, I think, exercise a great deal of caution, a great deal of wisdom in confronting them. And that's what these two priests were doing, Zadok and Abiathar. And the two sons of Zadok and Abiathar, look at that verse 16. It says, and now therefore quickly tell David, saying, do not spend the night at the fords of the wilderness, but by all means cross over, and at least the king and all the peoples who are with you be destroyed. Now Jonathan and Ahimeaz were staying at the Engrogel, and a maidservant would go and tell them, and they would go and tell King David, for they could not be seen entering the city. So what's happening here is that Zadok and Abiathar, you know, they're acting as spies, they're the priests acting as spies on behalf of David, and they convey this message from Hushai. They convey it to the servant girl, and then she's going to go outside the city and convey it to, you know, the sons of the priest, which were Jonathan and Ahimeaz, and then they're the ones who are going to go to David to tell them this. But look at that verse, pick up that verse 17 again. Now Jonathan and Ahimeaz were staying at the Enrogel, and a maidservant would go and tell them, and they would go and tell the king, for they could not be seen entering the city. But a lad did see them and told Absalom. So the two of them departed quickly and came to the house of the man in Baruim, who had a well in his courtyard, and they went down into it. And the woman took a covering and spread it over the well's mouth and scattered grain on it, so that nothing was known. And Absalom's servants came to the woman at the house and said, where are Ahimeaz and Jonathan? And the woman said that they have crossed the brook of the water. And when they searched and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. And it came about after they had departed that they came up out of the well and went and told King David. And they said to David, arise and cross over the water quickly, for thus Ahithophel has counseled against you. Then David and all his people who were with him arose and crossed the Jordan. And by dawn, not even one remained who had not crossed the Jordan. Now when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey and arose and went to his home, to his city, and he set his house in order and strangled himself. Thus he died and was buried in the grave of his father. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan, and he and all the men of Israel with him. And Absalom set Amaziah over the army in the place of Joab. Now Amaziah was the son of a man whose name was Jithar, the Israelite, who went into Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zeruiah, Joab's mother. And Israel and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. Now when David had come to Mahanaim, Shobai, the son of Nahash, from Rabbah, the son of Amnon, Machir, the son of Ammiel, from Lodebar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite, from Rogue Gileam, brought beds and basins of pottery, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans, lentils, parched seeds, honey, curds, sheep, cheese of the herd for David and for the people who were with him to eat. For they said, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. Now, what does this remind you of when it says that these two sons of the priest, Jonathan and Ahimeaz, they were informed by this maidservant girl, and they were going to try to get the message to David. But I guess there were spies all over the place, and one of the young kids saw them. He told Absalom, so they went looking for these two guys. Interesting thing. What happened when they went looking for these two guys? Because it says here, verse 18, but a lad did see them and told Absalom, so the two of them departed quickly and came to the house of the man in Baruim, who had a well in his courtyard, and they went down into it. And the woman took a covering and spread it over the well's mouth and scattered grain on it. What does that remind you of? Anybody remember?
Rahab.
Reminds you of Rahab. That's exactly how she saved the two spies, right? The king was looking for them in the city of Jericho, and she took them up to the top of the roof and hid them under some flocks, and told the soldiers that were looking for them that they were there, but they had already left. And she threw them off. And then this woman, Rahab, is mentioned in the book of Hebrews, and she's mentioned in other places of Scripture as a woman who acted on her faith, acted on her belief. And here again, I think this is kind of put here for our instruction, because in this conflict that we're in right now, between the powers of darkness, between this conflict between light and darkness, between Christ and Satan, it's not enough to just give Christ head acknowledgement. And this woman here put her own life in jeopardy by hiding these two spies, basically, right? And by doing that, she acted on her faith, right? And you see a great deal, I think, a similarity between this woman and what Rahab did, because she's mentioned in the Hall of Fame in terms of chapter 11 of Hebrews as being a woman who acted on her faith and acted on her belief. It wasn't just head acknowledgement. And as a result of that, we all know that she ended up being one of the great ancestors of Jesus Christ when she became a proselyte and converted to Judaism and gave her life to God. In spite of her past, and this woman acts on her belief and saves these two men. And what happened that they're able to escape because of it and get this message to David. And they tell David, hey, man, you need to cross over now. You need to get over this Jordan. And if you can look at this map here, I know it's kind of hard to see, but David starts from Jerusalem. And he got to cross over this Jordan right here. And he's going to the Mahanaim, which is up here. So we're talking that David is making a trek of almost 50 miles and trying to escape from Absalom. And he's told, cross over that Jordan River. And do it right now. Don't wait, because in the morning it may be too late. So everybody crosses over, and once they get across that natural barrier, that boundary line, it gives them, I think, a little breathing room between the forces of Absalom. And so now they're heading off to Mahanaim to try to, basically set up camp and set up a new headquarters there. But again, look what happens here, because it talks about this individual. In that verse 27, now when David came to Mahanaim, Shobai, the son of Naash, this is a guy who, what does he do? He brings all these different things to David. Look what he brings, because I think it's listed here for, I think, our instruction. I mean, it just doesn't say that this individual just brought David and his men supplies, because it lists it in order. I mean, it lists it in detail, because it says here that he brought beds and basins and pottery and wheat and barley and flour and parched grain and beans and lentils and parched seeds and honey curds and sheep and cheese of the herd for David and for the people who are with him to eat, for they said the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. And, you know, again, you know, I go back to John 15, where Jesus talks about his friends, because he said that no greater love has any man had to lay down his life for his friends, and you are a friend if you do what he asks of you. But, you know, when we get further on here, I think we're going to see a situation where even family members are going to be split as far as who they're going to throw their lot in with. And again, I can't emphasize this enough in terms of, if we're going to follow Christ, we're going to throw our lot in with him. It's got to be far more than head acknowledgement, far more than lip service. It's got to be action. It's got to be something that's put into action, just like this woman and the two spies and about this individual, Shobai, who brings all of these different things.
All three guys.
Right.
Not all that stuff.
They bring this, all these provisions, and it's all listed there. And it's Jesus himself who made it abundantly clear that, if we give so much a cold glass of water in his name, it won't lose its reward. And I think that this is put here for our instruction. If we're going to follow Christ, it's going to cost us something. And what we give Christ in this conflict, I think, it's not going to be overlooked by God, because we are told in Hebrews that God is not unfaithful, God is not unjust to us. Forget the love that we've shown towards his name in ministering and continue to ministering unto his saints. Anybody have anything you want to add to that? Chapter 17.
Can you explain the hanging part?
Oh, yeah, good, because I missed that. I think that's pretty darn significant. Look at that verse 23. It says, now when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey and rose and went to his home, to his city, and set his house in order and strangled himself, and he died and was buried in the grave of his father. Now, you know, Ahithophel, people say, well, he went and hung himself because his advice wasn't followed. But what did he really hang himself for? Why did he commit suicide? It goes deeper than that. He knew this. Ahithophel was a man who had enough spiritual insight to know, hey, my advice was the good advice, was the sound advice, was the right advice. Hushai's advice was the wrong advice. And because Hushai had given that advice, Ahithophel was a man who could see clearly what was going to be the end result of his advice not being followed. He could see that, hey, this is going to give David the time that David needs to regroup and to organize and to counterattack. And he knew that if David had that opportunity to do that, that Absalom would be defeated. He could see Absalom's defeat. He could see it clearly a mile away. He could see what was going to happen. So what does he do? He goes and hangs himself. Why? Because of his treachery, right? Because he knows David's going to return here, and then what's going to happen to him? He's going to be executed. So he just sees it, what's happening. All Ethopol, well, who does he remind you of in the New Testament? Who?
Judas.
He's a traitor. He sold out, you know, Judas sold out Christ for 30 pieces of silver. And you got to ask yourself, why did all Ethopol sell out David? Now, I said earlier that this is totally speculative, but if you look at these, just the brief verses that are given to us in terms of who Uriah was and who Bathsheba was and who her father was, you get an indication that Ahithophel was actually Bathsheba's grandfather.
If it's the same Ahithophel.
And I think it is, because it says it's the Ahithophel from the Gileonite, and it's the same thing here, right? So it's the same guy, but I'm just simply saying, what motivated him to throw his lot in with Absalom and say that he may have been bearing a grudge or harboring a grudge for a long, long time? I don't know. But look at what Judas did. You wonder, why did Judas sell out Christ? Well, he sold him out for 30 pieces of silver. But was it really the silver that he sold out Christ for? What did he really sell out Jesus for?
Get his dream.
Yeah. And he felt like, hey, man, I've been following this guy for three and a half years and sleeping outdoors and not having a place to lay my head and, you know, not having two nickels rubbed together and just dealing with people day in and day out, and I just exhaust myself thinking that I'm going to get a kingdom here. And this is going nowhere fast. And I'm not getting my kingdom. And so he said, I'm going to get something for all of my time, money, energy, and effort. And so he became more and more resentful, more and more bitter. And he ended up selling out Christ. Well, and then he goes out and hangs himself when he realizes, hey, man, he really threw in his lot with the wrong crowd. You see kind of a prefigurement here, Ahithophel and Judas? Like I said, you know, you look at David's life and you see tremendous parallels between the life of David and the life of Jesus. Anybody have anyone to add or share?
No.